So I'd like to welcome everyone back to this seventh session of this Shamatha practice program based on the mindfulness of breathing. So as per normal, let's begin by setting motivation, and we can do this in our own way and setting the best possible motivation. So let's have a look at what we'll be covering in this evening's session. As usual, we'll start with a review of some of the earlier points. We'll go back to the meditation that we did in the last session, that is the mindfulness of breathing, focusing at the entrance of the nostrils. And then we'll look at these prerequisites for shamatha training, how to set up our life in such a way to support this training. Then we'll go back to the actual practice of focusing at the nostrils and a second meditation on that. And then we'll have some time for question and answer at the end of the session. So this is the second of two sessions based on focusing at the nostrils. We began the first session with an introduction into this training. Then we had two sessions doing the full body breath practice, including one of those, how to meditate using the Shavasana posture, and two sessions focusing at the abdomen, and then now two at nostrils, and the next session on Thursday, the last session, on integrating into daily life. So as I mentioned, in this session will be one of the main topics is these prerequisites, these six prerequisites that are often described in the meditation text on shamatha on how to set up our life in such a way to support this practice. And then in the earlier sessions, we looked at preparing body, speech, and mind way back in session one. And then for the actual shamatha practice meditation, we looked at a number of topics, including what qualities we're cultivating. We saw there the importance of relaxation as the basis for developing stability and clarity of attention. In terms of objects, we saw there that the most widely emphasized object within Buddhist traditions is the breath, and that's what we're doing in this program. And this is also the one that is recommended in Attention Revolution from Alan Wallace, particularly in the beginning stages. And he also recommends two other objects, that is observing the mind and resting in awareness, as very suitable objects to use for shamatha practice, particularly for us in the modern world. We saw also the two main tools we use were mindfulness and introspection, to tie our mind with a rope of mindfulness to the object, and then the quality control of introspection to hook the mind back when we notice we've become dull or distracted. And then we had a look at that presentation of the five faults and the eight antidotes. And by applying those eight antidotes to those five faults, we can progress along those nine stages to shamatha that we looked at in session four and five. And we'll be looking at how to integrate this practice into daily life in the next session. That's going to be the main topic there. One or two things I want to review a little bit more before we go to the meditation. And that is the two main imbalances in this shamatha practice. Simply, you could say dullness and distraction. The technical terms are laxity and excitation. And so we saw in that color diagram that the elephant is symbolizing the mind, and the black color of the elephant is symbolizing this laxity or dullness. And we saw in the Lamrim Chemo from Tsongkhapa that he says that laxity means that your ways, mind of apprehending the object of meditation is slack and does not apprehend the object with much vividness or firmness. And so we of the nine stages, there are a number of levels of laxity, from very heavy laxity, even to the point of falling asleep, to more subtle level of laxity where the mind is not very sharp, very subtle level of laxity where the object is appearing clearly, and we in an earlier session that in terms of remedying laxity, we can talk levels of laxity, sharpen the focus, sharpen our focus without, of course, tensing, just paying closer attention to the object to uplift the mind, to clear, make the mind more clear. So if we only have slight laxity, that's to just sharpen the attention. If we have stronger laxity and that doesn't really work, then we need to take a step back from the object. And here Tsongkhapa is saying, inspire yourself by cultivating delight in terms of reflecting on, for example, the benefits of this shamatha practice, reflecting on, he also talked about, I think, bodhicitta and so forth. So to uplift the mind, make the mind joyful, to go back into the practice. And then if we have very strong laxity, and cultivating delight doesn't even really work, then Tsongkhapa says, suspend your cultivation of concentration, clear away laxity, and then resume your meditation. In this regard, a sangha suggests such activities as going for a walk and washing your face with water. So we see three levels of what to do with laxity. If it's slight, just sharpen. If it's much more heavy, then we need to uplift the mind by reflecting on some uplifting topic. And if that's not even working, we need to cut the meditation, go out, splash some water, go for a walk, do whatever we need to do to overcome that laxity and then come back to the meditation. And similarly, we had excitation. And we saw there in the color chart that the monkey is symbolizing just proliferation of conceptual thoughts, discursive mind in general, and the black color is symbolizing excitation. We saw there that the most common form of distraction is we are excited by the so-called sense pleasures that pull us away. So again, like laxity, we have three levels of what to do if we're coming into under excitation. And Tsongkhapa says first, what is excitation? It is an unquiet state of mind considered a derivative of attachment, which pursues pleasant objects and acts as an impediment to shamatha. So again, if we only have very slight excitation, then the recommendation is just draw in the scattered attention and fix your attention upon the object of meditation. So there we had those key terms of simply when we notice we're agitated and distracted, simply relax, release the distraction and return to the object. If the excitation is stronger and that doesn't really work, we just can keep getting scattered, distracted, then similar to laxity, we need to stop focusing on the object. And here, Tsongkhapa says, calm it by bringing impermanence to mind. So to bring the mind down by reflecting on things like impermanence, that the things we're chasing after are impermanent and they're never going to really satisfy us and fulfill us. So we can bring the mind down from that excitation state. If that doesn't work and we have very strong laxity, excitation, then like very strong laxity, we need to stop the meditation. So here he says it is crucial that you relax the meditation for a while and cultivate a sense of disenchantment rather than attempting to pull in your mind and go back to the object of the meditation. And so therefore, same thing, you disenchantment here is really to go away and think about the disadvantages of all these chasing after all these sense pleasures and so forth. And so really to release that excitation, that craving and attachment through that reflection and then come back to the meditation. So we have these sort of three sort of strategies for whether excitation is only slight, strong, or very strong. However, the best cure is preventing laxity and excitation. So prevention is the best cure. So there are a few things we can do to help prevent the likelihood of laxity and excitation in our meditation. The first is the body, in terms of the body and the posture. So if we're sort of bending over, we don't have a straight back, then probably we're going to fall into laxity or dullness. If it's too erect and the head too high, maybe excitation. So setting up a good posture. And also if we don't have a good posture and start to have aches and pains during the meditation, then of course that's going to cause distraction. So we want to be able to set a good posture, and so basically set and forget, so that the body doesn't create any problems during the meditation. The eyes, if we meditate with eyes closed, probably going to fall into laxity. If we have them too open, too much light, maybe excitation. So that we can adjust depending on whether we are more likely to have laxity or excitation. A big reason for laxity and dullness in meditation in the modern world is we simply do not get enough sleep, is that we don't seem to have enough time for everything. And so the thing we tend to cut is our sleep. We tend to cut from 8 to 7 to 6 to 5 to 4 hours, and then we sort of drink lots of coffee to keep us going during the day. So if we're not getting enough quality sleep, meditation is definitely not going to work. We're just going to fall into dullness and drowsiness. Diet is another one, particularly the modern diet, one of the biggest culprits here in terms of interfering in shamatha, causing both laxity and excitation, is not only refined foods, but particularly sugar. Sugar is an absolute disaster for a shamatha practice. You just go up and down, up, down, up, down. So we need to have a nice, healthy diet. And also exercise, of course, because the body is the support for the mind. Also, environmental things we can have a little bit of a control over. One of the biggest causes of distraction as a beginner is noise. So try to find a place that's quiet for meditating. If at home where you meditate, it's not normally quiet, maybe you're living next to a busy road or a noisy place, then I highly recommend noise cancelling headphones. I use them all the time when I'm in a noisy environment. I find them very, very helpful. The good quality ones can be a little bit expensive, but I think for me, money well spent. Temperature. If you where you meditate is too warm, dullness, drowsiness. Too cold, maybe excitation. And light. Adjust the light according to your disposition. If it's too dark, maybe you fall into dullness. Too much light, excitation. So you adjust the lighting again according to your own disposition. Another one is the length of session, that we more is not necessarily better. So we always want to emphasize quality over quantity. If we try and meditate too long, then we're just going to get caught up in lots of dullness and distraction. And on this point, Tsongkhapa talks quite a bit about this in Lam Rim Chembo. So I'd like to read a few things that Tsongkhapa says about length of sessions. And there's a sort of, in his text, there's a hypothetical question that someone asked that says, when you fix your attention on the object of meditation with mindfulness, is there a definite length for the session? And his reply is, on this matter, all earlier gurus of the various Tibetan lineages say that you have to do numerous short sessions. So many short sessions is always the recommendation for beginners. And he says, why? Some say that if you meditate in brief sessions and stop when it is going well, you will still be eager to meditate at the end of each session. And that's definitely true. If we meditate too long, then we're going to sort of fall into dullness and distraction, and we're just going to end always on a bad note. And that the thing we remember most about meditation is how it ended. So if we're always ending on a bad note, we're not going to be very enthusiastic about meditating again. Whereas if we keep the session short and it's going well when we finish, we'll, as Tsongkhapa says, we'll be enthusiastic to meditate again. He says, while if the session is long, you will become weary. Others explain that if the session is long, it is easy to fall under the sway of laxity and excitation. So it is hard to develop flawless concentration. And then he goes on, skipping a few paragraphs. He says, usually one of two things will happen when you are a beginner and have a long session. On the one hand, you may become distracted due to forgetfulness. In this case, you will not recognize the occurrence of any laxity or excitation quickly, but only after a long period of time. On the other hand, though you may not lose your mindfulness, it is easy to fall under the sway of laxity and excitation, and you will not quickly recognize them when they occur. The first situation hinders the development of strong mindfulness. The latter hinders the development of strong introspection. Hence, it is very difficult to stop laxity and excitation. And then a little bit more, he says, if you have great forgetfulness ensuing from distraction, as well as introspection so weak that it does not quickly recognize laxity and excitation, then your session must be short. If it is hard for you to forget the object and you can quickly notice laxity and excitation, it does not matter if the session is a little long. In short, the duration has to comport with your mental capacity. So always emphasizing quality over quantity. And as a beginner, it's very much recommended to use a meditation timer, as we're doing in this program. The one I'm using is called Insight Timer. It's a very popular one. And again, for two reasons, it's at least two reasons, it's very good to use a timer as a beginner. If we don't use a timer, then sometimes when we're meditating, on some days, maybe our mind is very agitated, restless, distracted. And so we sit down to meditate and we can't really get into it. We try. Maybe we try for 5 or 10 minutes and then we stop because it's just not working. That's not a good habit to get into, because if we stop every time things get a little bit difficult, we're never going to progress in meditation. We're never going to progress in anything in our life. We have to develop perseverance in the case of difficulties. So if we've set a timer, and it's difficult, then we'll persevere. We'll be able to develop this persistence. So that's a very good quality to develop. And another reason to use a timer is other days, as Tsongkhapa mentioned, is that sometimes it's going really well. And then we go, oh, it's going really well today. So what do? We keep meditating. And then when do we stop? We stop when it's not going so well. And the thing we remember most about meditation is how it ended. So if we're always ending on a bad note, we're not going to be enthusiastic about meditating again. So therefore, very much recommended to use a timer. Now, if you want to meditate longer in your morning meditation session, let's say you want to meditate 30 minutes or 45 minutes or even an hour, but you can't sustain that, then break it into shorter sessions. So if you're maybe break it into 2 15-minute sessions or 2 20-minute sessions with a little break in the middle. Always emphasize quality over quantity. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the last session, session 8 as well. The other thing in terms of helping us to prevent the likelihood of laxity and excitation in our meditation is enthusiasm. If we're not enthusiastic about this meditation practice, then very quickly in our meditation, we're just going to fall into complete dullness and drowsiness or complete unbridled daydreaming and distraction. A little bit like if we're at home in the evening, we're watching a program on TV and we find it boring, then of course we're going to get very dull and drowsy or just go off on some daydream. So therefore, to cultivate enthusiasm, and we can do that a number of ways. One, to reflect on the benefits of this practice that we saw earlier, and I think in the first session, the benefits of this shamatha practice in terms of daily life, improving our attention skills, but also as this practice being a gateway to genuine happiness. So if we reflect on the benefits, again, we have faith in the practice, that then we'll aspire to do the practice and we'll have more enthusiasm to do the practice. Also, motivation. If our motivation, and we'll talk more about this in the last session, session 8 as well. If our motivation, or put it this way, if our worldview is that the source of my happiness is out there in the world, and our motivation to do this practice is so I can maybe get more of those things out there, then you're just going to get caught up in lots of distraction and excitation. So therefore, have a motivation based on the fact that this practice is a doorway to genuine happiness and that the happiness is coming from within. And also try to make your motivation as expansive as possible. Here in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, we're trying to cultivate the motivation of bodhicitta. For example, we may have a very good motivation to do this practice, but if that motivation is only limited to ourselves in terms of I'm doing this practice for my benefit, my own benefit, then if things get a little bit difficult, it'll be more likely that we will give up. Whereas if we've included others in our motivation, that we're not only doing this for our own benefit, but we're doing it so we can be of more benefit to those around us, then we're more likely to persevere in the face of hardship or difficulty in the practice. And so then we have that last quote here, talking a little bit about this enthusiasm from Tsongkhapa again. If you cannot stop the laziness of being disinclined to cultivate concentration and of enjoying things that are not conducive to it, i.e. chasing after sense pleasures, from the outset, you will not gain entry into concentration. So we won't be able to get into the practice if we can't stop that laziness. So again, one key element, which we're going to talk about more in the next session, is the shifting of worldview. That if we really want to have a lot of enthusiasm for this practice, we really need to shift that worldview. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next session. So that's a few of the things we can do to help prevent the likelihood of laxity or excitation arising in meditation. And then also in earlier sessions, we looked at how we can progress through these 9 stages, relying on the 8 antidotes to abandon the 5 faults. So we went through those a little bit briefly in, I think, session 4 and session 5. And we also looked there at the goal of shamatha and beyond shamatha. So I'd just like to mention that again a little bit. What to do once we get to shamatha. Here in the color diagram, we see the diagram up in the top right-hand corner is describing the wisdom or vipassana practice. And we saw there that the description was saying the root of samsara is cut by the union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. Equipped with mindfulness and introspection, seek the correct view of emptiness. So therefore, on the basis of shamatha, we engage in vipassana practice. As I think I mentioned earlier, this doesn't mean that first we need to achieve shamatha before we begin our vipassana practice. If we do that, we'll be waiting a long, long, long time. But what it does mean is that without shamatha, our vipassana practice won't be efficient enough or effective enough to gain a direct insight into the nature of reality, into an insight into emptiness. In fact, we can talk about 3 stages of emptiness practice. And here I like to use the Tibetan words, which are very short. The 3 Tibetan words are go, nyam, tok. So go in Tibetan means intellectual understanding. So first with emptiness practice, we need to listen to some teachings on emptiness to understand what emptiness is all about, to gain some intellectual understanding of emptiness, of nature of reality. However, even a very good intellectual understanding of emptiness is not going to change anything in our life, because our habits are not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our habits are driven by our instinctive habits. So if we really want to overcome that, we need to gain an insight into emptiness through meditation. So then we apply that intellectual understanding into practice. We meditate and we get to the second stage, which is nyam, which means taste or experience. So we meditate on emptiness. We have a little bit of a taste or an experience of emptiness. And that little experience of emptiness can affect the mind for a little while, maybe outside of the meditation. It may affect the mind still for some moments, minutes, hours, even days. And during that time where that emptiness experience is still affecting our mind, what we will notice is that our mind not only will be a little bit more calm, less mental afflictions, but what we'll notice also, we'll feel a little bit more connected with others and a little bit more loving kindness and compassion to others than normal. But that experience will wear off and we'll go back to our normal selfish habits with lots of mental afflictions. So what we want to do is to stabilize that experience to make it longer lasting, which is the third stage, TOC, or realization. And we're talking here about a direct realization of emptiness. To be able to do that, then we need a very stable and clear mind. We need the mind of shamatha. Therefore, we see here that the root of samsara is cut by the union of shamatha and vipassana, observing emptiness. So therefore, if we really want to get to that stage in our vipassana practice, then we really need to achieve shamatha. So that's all the review I wanted to do in this session. Let's now go to the meditation, the same meditation we did in the last session. So now we're doing mindfulness of breathing, focusing at the entrance of the nostrils, the tactile sensations of the in and out flow of the breath moving across this area. And we can focus either at the actual entrance of the nostrils or the small area above the upper lip, wherever you find more easy. So anywhere in this area, using bare attention, as we mentioned earlier. So we're not visualizing the breath coming in, going down, coming up and going out. We're not looking at the nose. We're simply focusing on the tactile sensations here directly. Now, because we're bringing our attention up, it's a much smaller area of focus, very conducive for improving clarity of attention. However, balance, meaning that to enhance or cultivate that clarity without losing the basis of relaxation and stability. Now, here in this practice, as we saw in the last session, there can be two common tendencies. One is that because it's a little bit more difficult to notice the sensations here, we tense, we tighten. So just be watchful for that. If you notice any tension around the face area, keep relaxing on the out-breath. Relax, relax, relax. And also, because it's difficult to pick up sensations here, sometimes people force the breath. So we don't want to do that either. Just breathe naturally. And we also mentioned, like the earlier practice of focusing on the abdomen, if you find yourself getting distracted a lot in this practice, you can bring in a little bit of counting or noting of the breath to help stabilize your attention. So that's it for the meditation. So we'll do that practice again now. So if you find a nice, comfortable posture, let's begin. Allowing your awareness to descend into the body and simply become aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face, all the muscles around the eyes, soft and relaxed. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Resting in stillness. And from that stillness, bring your attention to the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils, focusing directly on the tactile sensations at the entrance of the nostrils as the breath flows across this area. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. Keeping all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. And not trying to control the breath in any way. And if you're finding that you're constantly becoming distracted, then if you find it helpful, you can introduce counting or noting the breath to help stabilize the attention. and we can bring the meditation to a close. So let's look at the main topic for this session, and that is the prerequisites. And these prerequisites are described in the meditation texts in the context of what we need to do to prepare ourselves or to have the necessary conditions in place to be able to do a more intensive sort of shamatha retreat. However, when we go through these, I think you can see that even if we're not planning to go off and do some sort of longer retreat or so forth, that if we pay attention to these six prerequisites and try to build those into our life, then this is going to set ourselves up well for any sort of, I think, more meaningful lifestyle. So let's have a look at those. And to introduce them, I'd like to read from Attention Revolution briefly. He calls these preparing for an expedition. On page 50, he says, "When I lead shamatha seminars, I like to think of them as expeditions rather than retreats. The word retreat has the connotation not only of withdrawal, but also of defeat. And that certainly isn't the spirit of such practice. The word expedition, on the other hand, suggests adventure, conquest, and exploration. The Latin roots of the word have to do with extricating yourself, literally stepping out of some situation in which you've gotten stuck. In the practice of shamatha, we discover how deeply our minds are trapped in the twin ruts of excitation and laxity. In the Buddhist tradition, a mind trapped in these ruts is said to be dysfunctional. And in order to make it serviceable, it is helpful to step out of our normal activities, seek out a spacious sense of solitude, and explore the frontiers of the mind. This expedition doesn't require blind faith or allegiance to any religious creed or metaphysical belief system. Over the past three millennia, contemplatives from various Asian cultures with diverse belief systems have followed the path of shamatha to its culmination, and they have reported their findings. We don't need to accept their claims simply on their own authority, but if we're inspired by earlier accounts of the benefits of this practice, we may venture forth on this path to see for ourselves whether we can achieve the results of the contemplative explorers who have preceded us. There are great adventures ahead, but also perils and dead ends. Sometimes the path is clear, but now and then it may seem to disappear altogether. The purpose of relying on those who know this path from their own experience is to save time. Six prerequisites for sustained rigorous training are set forth in many Indian and Tibetan Buddhist meditation manuals. These are some of the essential causes and conditions that will produce the fruit of shamatha." So we have six prerequisites here. The first one is sort of like the outer conditions, and the other five are more inner conditions. The first one is supportive environment. And there we see there are five things mentioned: easy access, safe, healthy, good friends, quiet. And so this is described in Tsongkhapa's Lam Rim Chenmo. And he says the following: the area should have five attributes. Easy access. So remember, this is talking about a place where we go off and do some longer term retreat. So the necessities such as food and clothing are readily obtained. Being a good place to live. This is interesting. He says, where there are no wild beasts such as predators, no enemies, etc. Of course, in those old days, I think in India, there was a lot of forests and people used to go and meditate in the forest. But of course, if there was lions and tigers in the forest, that would be a little bit detrimental to our retreat. But also no enemies just reminds me of a friend of mine who actually is still in doing long-term shamatha retreat. But some years ago, he'd already begun his long-term shamatha retreat, and he was in a retreat in Mexico, And it was a good place, nice conditions and so forth. But in the end, he had to leave because the drug cartels were moving into the area and it was becoming a very dangerous place for him. So he had to leave. And I think he's now in Spain somewhere continuing his retreat. Third point, being a good piece of ground in that it does not breed sickness, so a healthy place, in other words. The fourth one, very important, offering good companionship insofar as your companions are ethically disciplined and like-minded. And so this we'll talk a little bit more about in the next session, but it's all about really, in Buddhism we talk about the word sangha, spiritual community, that it's very important, particularly as a beginner, to find like-minded people to help us, support us in our practice. Because if we try to do all of these things on our own, we have very strong habits, we're easily influenced, and we'll just get swept up in our old habits. I know from personal experience and talking to many, many people. So if we really want to do this or any sort of practice and move our life in a better direction, we need help. We need to find these like-minded people, get connected with them, support them, and they can support us. I can't overemphasize this point enough. And the fifth one, being well situated in as much that there is not many people about in the day and little noise at night. So again, a quiet place. So that's the outer conditions. Then we have five inner conditions. The next two sort of go together, having few desires and being content. And here we're talking about desires with respect to material possessions and wealth. So that's few desires is with respect to what we don't have, being content is with respect to what we do have. So just reading what Alan Wallace talks about this in his Attention Revolution, he says, the first of these two prerequisites refers to having few desires for things you don't have, and the second refers to being content with what you do have. Without these two qualities, your mind will never settle down in the practice. You will be constantly thinking of things you want but don't have, and you will fret that your present circumstances are inadequate in one way or another. This does not mean that you must quell your desire for happiness, but it is necessary to refocus your aspirations on transforming your own mind as a means to genuine well-being. And for this to happen, you must see the limitations of a life driven by such mundane pursuits as wealth, luxury, entertainment, and reputation. All these circumstances can give you is a temporary spurt of pleasure that tapers off as soon as the pleasurable stimulus stops. Mental balance is the gateway to finding genuine happiness, and shamatha is the key that opens that gate. And then few activities. That is to really simplify your life. You know, often I hear people say things like, oh, I'd really like to meditate, but I don't have time to meditate. I think that's never a valid excuse. Now, the reality is that many of us in the modern world have very busy lives. We never have enough time for everything. And there are some things we do each day which are essential. Most of us need to work at some level to have enough money, to have a roof overhead and food in the stomach and so forth. Some of us have got family responsibilities. Some of us have some other responsibilities. But above and beyond those essential responsibilities, we tend to fill up our day with lots of activities. And we tend to do it for one of two reasons. One is that it's felt, particularly in our modern society, that if you're not doing something, you're not being productive. So just do anything, do something. And if we're not doing anything and we're just sitting quietly, that really forces us to look at the state of our mind, which is a mess. So we just try and busy ourselves to distract ourselves so we don't have to look at the state of our mind. Now, we can forcibly cut things out of our life to make it simple, but I think this is always going to be a struggle. It won't work. Rather, we should do as recommended in most of the Buddhist traditions is some of the first initial reflections, and that is to reflect on precious human life, that we have a human life full of opportunities and it's not going to last forever. And if we reflect on these two things, internalize them, I think intellectually we all know that we've got opportunity and it's not going, our life's not going to last forever. We know that intellectually, but it doesn't affect us. So we really need to reflect and meditate on these, to internalize them, to experientially appreciate the preciousness of this life, that we've got lots of opportunity and it's not going to last forever, so that we can be inspired to make our life meaningful. And on that point, I'd like to read a short quote about death from Steve Jobs, who gave a talk some years ago to students at Stanford University. And he said, "When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, 'If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right.' It made an impression on me. And since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and ask myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, or pride or fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you're going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart." So I think some very good advice there from Steve Jobs. Then the fifth one is ethical discipline. And so we saw in all Buddhist traditions, ethics is the foundation. And I think ethics is really the foundation of any sort of meaningful lifestyle. And in Attention Revolution, not only is Alan Wallace talking about social ethics, which is normally what we mean by ethics, but he also talks about environmental ethics and psychophysical ethics in terms of ethically treating our body and mind. And the last one is let go of compulsive thinking. We all have some obsessive compulsive thinking about some things in our life. And a lot of that, again, is often based on the view that the source of my happiness and suffering is out there in the world. So we tend to have a lot of obsessive compulsive thinking, particularly about how am I going to get those things there that are going to make me happy? How am I going to avoid those things there that maybe cause me suffering? So if we can start to let go of this obsessive compulsive thinking, then that's going to be very helpful. And we'll talk more about that point in the next session. And then Tsongkhapa says, the most important ones are good ethical discipline, so ethical basis, seeing desires as disadvantageous, and dwelling in an appropriate area. So dwelling in an appropriate area, having good environment, particularly like-minded friends, very important. I want to just mention one thing here to avoid confusion, where he says seeing desires as disadvantageous. Does that mean we should give up all desires? No. Here he's using the word desire specifically relating to number point two, which is about craving and attachment for material possessions. This word desire, we have to be careful with. Often it's synonymous with craving and attachment. That we have to give up. But sometimes the word desire is used synonymous with aspiration. So we are not to give up a desire in terms of aspiration for genuine happiness or aspire to help others and so forth. Those desires we need to increase. But desires in terms of craving and attachment for pleasurable things, that's what we need to see as disadvantageous, because chasing after sense pleasures is not going to bring us any happiness. It's just going to waste our life, and it's just going to bring unnecessary suffering. And then the last point here, a summary of these 6 points, I'd just like to read from Alan Wallace, because this will tie into another topic that we'll cover in the next session. He says, in our material society, even for people who are drawn to non-materialistic values, there is a strong tendency to take our current way of life as the norm and then add meditation to fix it, like a band-aid applied to a festering wound. And that's actually a little bit what some of the modern day mindfulness traditions unfortunately do, is they just add a little bit of mindfulness to somehow fix, to soothe our dysfunctional way of life. So, and that's like putting a Band-Aid on a festering wound. That's not really, that's someone coined the term MUK mindfulness. That's like the fast food mindfulness, the McDonald's of mindfulness, to just add mindfulness, which is the main tool here, just add that on top of our life as it is. I think that's not very effective. In fact, it could make things worse. Then Al Miles goes on to, and we'll talk more about that in the next session. Al Miles says, my first experience with meditation in the late 1960s is a good example. I went to a teacher who gave me a mantra and told me how to meditate on it. But in these instructions, there was no reference to the way I should lead the rest of my life. Even now, decades later, meditation is often taught with little or no reference to any of the above prerequisites. It has been reduced to a kind of first aid to alleviate the symptoms of a dysfunctional life with all its anxieties, depression, frustration, and emotional vacillations. For a mind that is assaulted with a myriad of mental afflictions such as craving, hostility, and delusion, we need more than a medic. We need long-term intensive care. That's what this training is all about. So that's the six prerequisites, which I think we can also apply to our life, even if we're not planning to do a sort of a longer-term meditation retreat. So then we'll go on to the practice again. Just a few comments and then we'll go straight back to the meditation that we've been doing. Some reflections on the practice, and you can read more about this on page 74 in Attention Revolution. And he talks about how that just developing balanced attention really has a healing effect on the body and the mind. And we mentioned that in the earlier session as well. But one thing I want to mention specifically relating to this practice at the entrance of the nostril is this biofeedback loop that is present in this particular practice. And you may have noticed, if you've done this practice already, you may have noticed this, that if you're focusing here and your mind starts to calm down, then the breathing starts to calm down, which means the sensations here get subtler, which forces us to pay closer attention to this more subtle sensations, which helps, of course, to improve clarity of attention. But likewise, if we're focusing here and our mind is starting to get very agitated, then our breathing gets more coarse, the sensations are easier to detect, and that helps to avoid getting distracted. So we have this automatic biofeedback loop present here. That's a big advantage focusing here. One more point, and that is that particularly in mindfulness of breathing, as we are focusing on the breath, the mind is settled down and the breathing is settling down. What's happening is that the subtle energies in our body, which now are very much unbalanced, start to balance. And in the process of balancing, all sorts of physical sensations can happen in meditation. You can have a sense of a very heavy body, a light body, a big body, a small body, your sensation of floating and levitating, sensation there's no body. You can have a lot of tingling, vibration, heat is very common. All of these things can happen as a side effect of this practice. And the general recommendation is not to make a big deal of them, and don't get caught up in those meditative experiences. We tend to make a big deal of them and we really do get caught up in them, because if we're doing this sort of shamatha practice and then there's a blissful flow of sensations in the body, what do? We go, oh, that's so nice. I like that. I want that. And so as soon as we have craving for it, gone. And then what we do is we say, I want to recreate that. That was such a nice experience. And so we try to recreate that experience with craving and attachment. And of course, there's no way it's going to come back. And then we just get more and more and more frustrated, thinking, oh, I had such a wonderful experience 6 months ago. I can't do that again. Oh, poor me. And so then we've gone completely astray in the practice. Similarly, if we have some strange a sensation in the body or some unpleasant sensation, we go, oh no, what's that? I don't like that. Go away. And we have aversion. And then our whole practice comes to a grinding halt. So whether it's pleasant, strange, or unpleasant, let it be. It'll come. It'll go. Just stick to the practice. Don't make a big deal out of it. And then the last point, and then we'll go back to the meditation, is this idea of shifting gears. We said in this practice, in fact, in all practices, to have the basis of relaxation. However, as I mentioned, because we're bringing the attention up here and it's a much smaller focus, more difficult to focus, there is a very strong tendency to tense. And if we tense, we actually might be able to focus quite well here. In fact, we may be able to focus very clearly here. However, if we continue to focus here with that tension, then not only are we developing a bad habit that's going to be even more difficult to correct later, but we're going to get completely exhausted from that tension if we meditate longer. And eventually we're going to get very agitated. The mind's going to get very agitated. So therefore, in this practice, if you notice tension, and you particularly it's around across the forehead, around the eyes, the jaw, and at the back of the neck, if you notice any sort of tension building up in this area, even if you're focusing very clearly on sensations here, then you need to release that. Use the out-breath, release, release, release. And if you can't release the tension, don't stay here. Move back down into the body, either the full body breath practice or the abdomen. Establish the basis in relaxation and then once again go back to the nostrils. So don't stay here with tension. It's going to develop bad habit and you're going to get very agitated eventually. So let's go back to the practice. So we'll continue the practice, the same practices we've been doing. Also, what you might like to do is, I think I mentioned in an earlier session, is that we tend to go one way or another in our meditations. We tend to either start going off more and more into complete distraction, or we tend to start slowly going into more and more dullness, drowsiness. So what we can do is balance on every breath, in that the out-breath is a natural time to relax and release any tension and distraction. And the in-breath is a natural time to sharpen the focus, overcoming dullness. So if we relax and release on the out-breath and sharpen the focus on the in-breath, then we can balance and have relaxation and alertness together. So you might like to experiment with that as well in this session. So let's go back to the practice now, finding a nice comfortable posture. Let's begin. As always, we begin by preparing the body. So establishing a good posture. The two most important things with posture is keeping the back straight and allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed. And having established a good posture, then keeping the body as still as possible, avoiding any unnecessary movement. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. and setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. So not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future. In particular, letting go of any expectations for this meditation. Letting go of all of these things. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the stillness of the present moment. And whilst maintaining a basis of a relaxed body and a relaxed mind, bring your attention to the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. And monitoring that with introspection, noticing if you're becoming dull or distracted. And if so, then adjusting the focus accordingly. And if you wish, you can balance on each breath, relaxing and releasing any tension on the out-breath and sharpening the focus on the in-breath. if you notice any tension, particularly in the area around the face, and you can't release it, then shift gears back. Go back down into the body and focus on the sensations of the breath, either the full body or the abdomen. Re-establish the basis in relaxation and then return to focusing at the nostrils. And we can bring the meditation to a close. Now we have some time for Q&A. Have you got any questions, Miffy?
I'll give everyone a chance to type something into the chat. And meanwhile, I've got one where when you were talking about the outer prerequisites and having, you know, good companions, those, you know, ethical conduct and so on. So it strikes me that we get a lot of our advice from the internet, and a lot of stuff on the internet that comes up is often really tainted and full of controversy. So what's your criteria, and like, how do you keep your mind clean with that kind of thing?
Yeah, there's another presentation, I think also you find it in the Lam Rim, about the six factors that contribute to mental afflictions. And one of those is basically, I think in the old text, it talks about misleading friends or bad friends or something. And then there's another one that talks about false teachings or so forth. So that's sort of the cultural and society, basically. And these things, you know, often people say, oh, I'm an independent thinker. Well, no such thing, actually. I mean, because we're so much influenced by not only other people, but the things we read, the things we see, and just being in a certain culture, we become distorted. And so that becomes very obvious when we go into another culture that has some different norm. And then we realize, oh, hang on, I'm very much not very open-minded on that, am I? So I think that what in the Lam Rim and those points there, basically it says to not expose ourselves unnecessarily to these sorts of things. I think one of the sort of commitments or precepts that we take when we sort of, I think in refuge, is to, you know, avoid people who really lead us astray. That doesn't mean we get angry and get rid of bad people, but what it means is that if we're a beginner, to not allow ourselves to go into situations where we know we're going to react in a negative situation, in a negative way always. So to step back from those very heavy negative influences, both in terms of people and media and internet. So to be very selective in those things. As we go deeper into the practice, then actually we will need to search out these more extreme situations to go deeper. But as a beginner, we really need to protect ourselves a little bit from these negative influences, whether they're people, whether they're internet and so forth. So to use our discerning wisdom and discerning intelligence to evaluate those sorts of things.
Okay, and Liesl asks, because she wants to be less reliant on her phone, is there another way to be able to time your meditation that's not reliant on a mobile or an app?
just use a clock, normal old clock. I mean, I you know, things like this, you know, they usually, you can set timers or alarms on them, so you can use that instead of using a phone. But it, I think it is helpful as a beginner to time it.
And Andrew asks, why is it easier to meditate longer with a group than by oneself?
Because you have the group energy. And also because you're not doing it for yourself. I talked about the motivation because there are others doing it. So you have not only the group energy, but you have this sense that, you know, I'm doing it for others because we're together and we're doing it together. And so therefore, and usually in that group situation, it's being guided as well. So there are a number of reasons for that. Again, it's just at a subtle level, it can be just the group energy, but just the fact that you're doing it together with others makes it easier. And then if it's guided, then you don't have to be self-disciplined. So that's why I always recommend as a beginner if we want to do some retreat, start with group retreats because it's much easier than doing solitary. Even if you're trying to do a solitary retreat for 1 or 2 days, it's not easy. Not easy. Self-motivating, self-discipline, it's not easy.
Then Richard asks, he's not quite clear what mind and body pliancy is. Can you give a couple of examples of what this pliancy is?
Yeah. Physical pliancy or not pliant is really a sense of heaviness in the body. Mental pliant, when you're not mentally pliant, you have a lot of resistance. You know, like we sit down to meditate and we go, oh, no, I don't want to do that. Whereas if we have pliancy, then basic mental pliancy, it means that we have no resistance in the mind at all. We whatever we turn our mind to, we can do that without any resistance from the mind at all. And physical pliancy, we don't really have this sense of heaviness and lethargy in the body that, I said that when we really achieve pliancy, the body feels very light, like cotton. And I think one of the reasons is also at a more subtle level, the subtle energies are flowing much, much more freely and balanced than they are now. So we have this sense of heaviness in the body.
So the kind of mental toll that is taken when we're focusing on one topic or got our head in one headspace and then have to very quickly go over to something entirely different, is that because we get exhausted switching like that, is that because we don't have mental pliancy?
Well, I think also the... partly because if we have to force it, but partly is also I think that we have a lot of tension in the body and the mind. I mean, that's our habit. In our habit, particularly in the modern world, is we have a lot of stimulus. Our minds tend to be very chaotic. And so whenever we want to focus on anything or activity in our life, what do? Just we tense. And if we do that for a short time, we don't really notice it. But if we're doing that, If we do that, if we're at work and we have to focus all day long, I mean, at the end of the day, we're just completely exhausted. It's completely exhausting. And so if we can release that tension, if we can develop a basis of relaxation, then we can work, we can do those things much more effectively and not get exhausted. So, yeah.
Then Carolyn asked that she was aware of her natural breathing, but also involved with the abdomen rising and falling. So in this meditation, was that a distraction? Will it settle down with practice?
You mean when we're focusing at the nostrils, she noticed the abdomen?
Yes.
Yeah. What often happens is that if we're used to one thing, like we were just been doing the focusing on the abdomen. So if you've been doing that for some time, then your natural habit is to go there. And then if you shift to the nostrils, then probably initially you'll notice that your mind will tend to go back to the abdomen because that's habit, but that's okay. Just if you do that, just go back to the nostrils, go back and then we'll develop a new habit. And then after some time, we'll just stay at the nostrils. So it's just a matter of training. That's all.
And then Andrew asked, in the early stages, what percentage of time should we spend on breathing meditation and what percentage of time on analytical meditation?
How long is a piece of string? It really, that's a huge question. Just to give a sort of a very brief answer on that, and there are many things, and we'll talk a little bit about that maybe on the next session, but the brief answer is that for most of us in the modern world where our attention skills are quite poor, and it seems like studies show that every new generation now the average attention skill is going downhill dramatically. And one of the main reasons for that are these things here. They're one of the main culprits. If our attention skills are very poor, then I would emphasize doing more shamatha. Because without attention skills, we can put a lot of time and energy into other things like vipassana and compassion and sadhana practice and all sorts of things. And we don't really get anywhere because, you know, we may be doing a sadhana practice and we're just going blah, 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 blah. And nothing happens, you know. So therefore, we need to emphasize the shamatha. However, I wouldn't recommend only doing shamatha. That's a little bit unbalanced. So what I would recommend very briefly as a beginner, if our attention skills are poor, emphasize shamatha, but definitely add some of compassion and wisdom. And then if you're doing some sort of devotional practice, that can also be very helpful.
And then the very last question from Mari is, can you please just tell us who your gurus are, your current gurus or your teachers?
I've in the last sort of couple of years, well, I mean, His Holiness Dalai Lama, I've been very fortunate to spend quite a lot of time in India. So I've been, I mean, he's not my personal guru, but certainly he's someone I very much aspire to. And so I've been attending a lot of his teachings over the years, and I receive a lot of inspiration from His Holiness. And then in terms of more personal teachings, in the last couple of years, I've been following quite a lot Mingyur Rinpoche in terms of Mahamudra, and then now in the last couple of years with Alan Wallace and he does, of course, very much emphasizes shamatha. So they're the sort of the main teachers I've been engaged with in the last couple of years.
Thank you.
Okay. So that's it. So yes, we've run out of time. So let's stop there. So again, finishing with a dedication. So we can dedicate all of our efforts in this evening session, and we can dedicate individually according to the motivation that we set at the beginning of the session. Thank you. And one more session to go in this series on Thursday. It's all about integrating into daily life. So we'll talk a little bit more how to integrate these practices into daily life, because that's a very important point. So see you on Thursday, same time.